leg, which was wrapped knee to ankle in a bloody cloth which oozed crimson onto my boot, and it penetrated my clouded senses that I'd been wounded. The air was crackling with small arms fire, thunder was rumbling overhead, the rain was pelting harder than ever, and as Theodore turned from looking down the hill and strode past us without a word, tossing aside his rifle in the second gateway, I looked down the hill myself, and saw a sight which I can see still, clear as day, 40 years on. Only a stone's throw below us, the Ab musketeers were falling back from the wall, and above the parapet, a flag was fluttering in the fierce wind, a little way to the left of the gate. At first, I thought it must be some banner of Theodore's, but then there were helmets and khaki tunics either side of it, and now they were tumbling over the wall, and the flag was being flourished from side to side as the fellow carrying it was boosted up bodily by his mates to stand on the top. That was when I saw it was a regimental colour. And here they came, a regular flood of riflemen, whooping and cheering like billio, charging the Ab musketeers who fairly ran before them. Khaki tunics and white robes were struggling in the gateway, bayonets against spears and clubbed firearms on both sides. Khaki was winning, and as the Abs were driven back, some of our fellows were tearing aside the piled stones from the gates, which were thrust wide to admit a crowd of cheering attackers, sappers and pioneers, and a great mob of Irish of the Dukes. They chased the Abs along the wall, and spears and swords and muskets were being flung aside as their owners threw up their arms in surrender. A few of the hardier spirits were running up the rocky path towards us, turning to fire a last shot at our fellows, and getting a fusillade in return. Shots sang above us and splintered the rocks around us, and Wald Gabry ran from my side, seized Theodore's fallen rifle, and thrust the butt into my left armpit.
"Tenizou, Dejas! Tenizou! Up, up for our lives!"
Sound notion, and if you think it's agony to run hobbling with a splinter of steel buried in your calf muscle, you're right. But it's wonderful what you can do when Snyder slugs are buzzing about your ears. I knew better than to try to identify myself in the heat of battle. With my improvised crutch going and Wald Gabre holding me up t'other side, I lurched through the gate, screaming at every step, and ahead of us Ab civilians were scattering up the slope, mothers with chicos, old folk and striplings, all frantic to escape the murderous struggle behind us. 10 yards ahead, there was a great bale of forage bound with cords, 6 foot square, and a capital place to go to ground, for my leg was giving out, leaking blood like a tap. My improvised crutch slipped from my grasp, and I lunged at the bale and grabbed it to save myself, pitching headlong. I hauled myself round the bale by its cords, so that it was between me and the mischief behind, but lost my hold and fell on all fours, being damn noisy about it too, for my leg was giving me jip. Wald Gabry sprawled beside me, and then strong hands seized my arms and hauled me up, yelping. It was Theodore, gripping me under the shoulders and gently easing me into a sitting position, with my back to the bale.
"Be still."
He was breathing hard.
"Go, good and faithful servant," says he to Wald Gabry. "God prosper you, and have you in his keeping."
The lad hesitated, and Theodore laughed and slapped him on the arm.
"Go, I say. Get you to Tigre again. Take a king's thanks and blessing. Farewell, gun-bearer."
Wald Gabry turned and ran, and Theodore watched him disappear among the huts. Then he looked past the bale towards the second gate, still breathless and rubbing the rain from his face. The plain shammer over his shoulders was wringing wet and clinging to him. The firing behind had slackened, but there was a distant shouting of orders followed by a ragged cheer. He closed his eyes for a moment and sighed before he spoke. And these were his words, and mine, on that rainy afternoon on Magdala Height. "Theodore,
I shall never go to Jerusalem now. There will be no 10th crusade."
Draws pistol, offers it butt first.
"Suicide is an abomination in God's sight, a sin not to be forgiven. Oh, friend, will you do a last kindness to your enemy?"
Flashy. "Don't be a bloody ass. Throw it away, man. They ain't coming to kill you. Put up your hands and give in, can't you? It's all up, damn it." Theodore.
"You will not. Do I ask too much, then? So be it. Perhaps God, who marks the fall of humble sparrows and proud kings, will forgive even this in his infinite mercy.
Flashy. God don't give a tuppenny damn one way or t'other. Give over, you crazy bastard. But he was cocking the piece, and now he put the muzzle in his mouth and his thumb on the trigger and blew the back of his head away. The explosion threw him back, off his feet, but by some freak convulsion of his hand, the pistol flew into the air and fell beside my wounded leg. His body twitched for a few seconds, and then shrank and was still, head on one side and a bloody puddle spreading beneath it. I could see his face, unmarked, impassive, untroubled, the eyes closed as though in sleep. Do you know, I wasn't even shocked at the abruptness of it. It seemed fit and proper somehow, and I thought then, what I think still, that it was a thing almost foreordained, as though he'd been searching for it all his life. And there it was, and that was all about it. Short, sweet, simple, and saved everyone a deal of bother. I clenched my eyes shut with a spasm of pain, and when I opened them, my eye fell on the pistol, and on the silver plate on its stock. I picked it up, and laughed aloud, but not in mirth. The plate was engraved, "Presented by Victoria, Queen of Great Britain and Ireland, to Theodorus, Emperor of Abyssinia, as a slight token of her gratitude for his kindness to her servant Plowden, 1854. Ironic, you'll agree, but now came a clatter of running feet, and into sight on my right came two khaki ruffians, helmets askew, dirty, bearded faces alight with devilment. The nearer covered me with his rifle.
"Jesus, you're white," cries he. "Who the hell are you, then, and what's to laugh at? Put up that piece and come to attention, you rascal."
I've encountered T. Atkins and P. Murphy often enough to know how to bring him to heel with the battle lusties on him.
"I'm Colonel Sir Harry Flashman, 17th Lancers. Get me a medical orderly." "In the name of God," cries Paddy. "And is it yourself, then, Sir Harry?" "Be Christ it is, and so ye are. 'Tis himself, Mick, de Flash fella. Begging your pardon, Sir Harry."
"Are you sure?" says Mick, all suspicion.
"He looks like a bloody Badoo to me."
"Badoo? Will you hear him? Did I not see old Slowcoach pinned a cross on him at Allahabad? Begging his pardon and all, Sir Colin, I should say. But man, Sir Harry, I doubt you're wounded."
"Who's the nigger?"
demands Mick, scowling at Theodore's corpse and plainly still doubtful of me.
"The King of Abyssinia," says I. "Let him be. And damn your eyes, get me an orderly and a stretcher."
"At once, at once," shouts Paddy. "Run, Mick, and see to it. Just you, boy, there, Colonel Sir Harry, sir, and give your mind peace."
"There's no 17th Lancers in your man's column," says Mick. "And if there was, what's he doing here ahead of the colours, even? Tell me that, Shaughnessy."
Shaughnessy told him in Hibernian terms, but I paid him no heed, for more bog-trotters were arriving, with wild hurrahs and halloos, pausing a moment to gape at me, and then at Theodore's body. For now there were abs on hand tugging at their sleeves and pointing,
"To Woodrus, Te Woodrus."
Presently the man, Mick, returned with an orderly, who set to work on my injured calf, making me yell with the fiery bite of raw spirit in the wound, and drawing cries of delight and commiseration from my audience, as he held up a gleaming 2-inch sliver of shrapnel, which he had removed from my quivering flesh.
"Natus Hogan's knapsack," they cried. "A darling little spike. Compliments of Colonel Penn."
And laughed heartily, urging me to
"Be easy, Sir Harry, dear, for I must have taken worse at Balaclava. Sure, and I had. Is it not so, eh, Madigan?"
It was a mercy when a colour sergeant came bawling for them to fall in, and they melted away, all but the orderly and Private Pat Shaughnessy, my self-appointed sponsor and protector. And suddenly I felt not too poorly at all, for all the throbbing discomfort of my leg and my aching skull, sitting with my back to the bale in the gentle rain. I'd been here before, wounded and propped up against a gunwheel at Gwalior 10 years since, at the end of the Great Mutiny, with the same tired, overwhelming feeling of relief, because I knew 'twas all over at last. And here I was, none too much the worse, watching content as the Duke of Wellington's Irish fell in, with the markers shouting and a young chap was planting the colour to thunderous cheers and helmets flying before all came to attention for God Save the Queen, followed by Rule Britannia, and the orderly was bidding Shaughnessy bring me a stretcher, and a huge figure with a spreading black beard was stooping over me with a roar of greeting, and my hand was being gripped in an enormous paw.
"Good God!" cries Speedy. "Sir Harry!" "Right enough you are, Your Honour," agrees the departing Shaughnessy. "'Tis himself, so it is, and none other." "You're wounded," cries Speedy. "But you're well, what? Oh, this is famous. It will crown Sir Robert's day. We'd almost given you up after Prideaux said Theodore wouldn't release you."
He pumped my hand, beaming.
"And here you are! And what a splendid job you did with the gallows. Sealed this amber tight as a drum. Oh, aye, we know how he tried to run for it. But who'd have thought Magdala would fall so fast and easy? Thanks to you, sir. Thanks to you."
Which was music to the ears, of course. And then he glanced round at a cry of, "To Wootros! To Wootros!" And there was an ab eagerly identifying Theodore's body for a couple of officers who'd just come up. Now, what followed meant nothing to me at first, but it did an hour later, after, well, the events I'm about to relate. They're no great matter, but they provide an interesting glimpse of human nature, I think, and demonstrate how people will believe what they want to believe, and honourable men will swear to what they think is a damn lie, never realising that it happens to be true. Thus, Speedy heard the ab and stared, shot me a brief wandering glance, and strode across to the corpse. He bent over it and came back, exclaiming, "Phew!" in astonishment. Then he checked, and I saw he was looking at my left hand, which, to my surprise, was resting on Theodore's revolver. Speedy glanced back at the body, then at me, with just a hint of knowing in his eyes, and stooped quickly to snatch up the gun and thrust it under his tunic.
"We'll have you under cover in a jiff, out of the rain," cries he.
And Shaughnessy, arriving with a stretcher, he and the orderly bore me into one of the thatched houses nearby. Speedy chivvied them away, Shaughnessy adjuring me to
"have a care, Sir Harry, man dear."
And outside the bands were striking up "Hail the Conquering Hero Comes," almost drowned out by another great roar of cheering. It was Napier, never far behind the infantry as usual, come to take possession of his conquest. Speedy stood chafing in the doorway, and I heard him summon a soldier and order him to stand guard and let no one in or out. There were a couple of scared-looking ab women in the house, and Speedy dashed them some dollars, telling them to give me a flask of Tej and whatever else I might need. Then he was off, promising to be back presently, and I guess about an hour passed, in which I discovered I could walk with only a little discomfort, and the women brought me some humbasha, and I sat listening to the bands playing and the bustle and shouted orders, until I heard Speedy returning, and Napier with him. His voice raised in anger, which wasn't his style at all.
"Have him covered up at once," he was barking. "Good God! Was there ever anything more disgraceful? Have him taken into a house directly and made decent. Has the Queen been informed? Ah, Rassam is seeing to her. Very good."
I was to learn that his great bait was about Theodore's body lying in the rain, stripped almost naked by chaps seeking souvenirs. Speedy said something I didn't catch, and Napier said,
"To be sure, the doctors must examine the body tomorrow and report to a board of inquiry. Now, where is our ambassador extraordinary?"
This, as he appeared in the doorway, helmet in hand, with Speedy at his elbow, muttering that the less said the better, at all costs the press mustn't get wind.
"Sir Harry."
Napier was gripping my hand, eyes alight in the tired old face.
"No, no, no. Sit still, my dear fellow. Not too painful a hurt, I trust? Oh, that's good news."
Then he was echoing Speedy's earlier congratulations, thanking me for
"a task well done, as only you could have done it,"
without which the campaign might have come adrift, and so forth, etc.
"It was a body blow when we learned you'd been taken, I can tell you. But we'll hear all about that presently, and your other adventures. For the moment, it's enough that you're here."
He beamed, paused a moment, and sat down, fingering his dreary moustache.
"So, the work's done, by the mercy of Providence." says he. And the king is dead. A sad end, but not untimely. How did it happen?
I told him straight. Suicide. He glanced at Speedy and nodded.
Suicide, says he. I see.
Something in his tone made me repeat it. That's right, sir. He put the piece in his mouth and let fly. Another thoughtful nod.
Apart from yourself, was any other person present?
No, sir. No one.
Very good.
He looked decidedly pleased.
Very good. Dr. Blanc will confirm your account when he examines the body tomorrow.
Johnson will convene the Board of Inquiry. They'll make it official, says Speedy. Suicide, that is.
There followed a brief silence, during which I kept a straight face. Suddenly, it had become plain that they were under the incredible delusion that I had shot Theodore, but they didn't care to say so in as many words, which was vastly diverting. Of course, it was what they'd wanted, and had hinted to me through Prideaux, and Speedy, having seen the pistol in my hand and Theodore stark and stiff, had concluded that I'd done the dirty deed to save HMG the painful embarrassment of having to try and possibly hang the black bugger.
No one must ever know, Sir Robert. Controversy, press gang, scoundrel, Stanley, questions in the house, uproar, regicide, scandalum magnatum, honour of the army.
Which explained why, within an hour of the last shot in the war being fired, when the commander-in-chief should have been consolidating his victory with 100 important military matters awaiting his decision, he was here, post-haste, to ensure a conspiracy of silence. Leave me in no doubt that I'd not suffer for my good deed, and join Speedy in regarding me with that rather awed respect, which says more clearly than words, Gad, you're a ruthless son of a bitch, thank God. I might have protested my innocence, but I didn't get the chance. Napier was addressing me in his gentlest voice, with that old familiar bug-hunter smile.
Harry, he began.
So, I was Harry now. Without any formal honorific. Well, well.
Harry, you and I have known each other ever so long. Yes, ever since you lobbed that blessed diamond at old Hardinge. Here, catch.
He gave a stuffed chuckle.
You should have seen their faces, Speedy. However, that's by the way.
He became serious.
Since then, I have known no officer who has done more distinguished service or earned greater fame than you.
No, no, it's true. He checked my modest grunts with a raised hand.
Well, what I wish you to know is that whatever services you may have done in the past, none has been more gratefully valued than those performed in Abyssinia. I refer not only to your mission to the Queen of Gala, so expertly accomplished, but to that other service which you have done today.
He paused, choosing his words, and when he resumed, he didn't look at me directly.
I know it cannot have been easy for you. Perhaps to some of our old comrades, those stern men with their iron sense of duty, men like Havelock and Hope Grant and Hodson, God rest them, it might have seemed nothing out of the way. But not, I think, to you. Not to one in whom I believe duty has always been tempered with humanity, yes, and chivalry. Not,
he concluded, looking me in the eye,
to good-hearted Harry Flashman.
He stood up and shook my hand again.
Thank you, old fellow. That said, we'll say no more.
If I sat blinking dumbly, it was not in manly embarrassment, but in amazement at his remarkable misreading of my nature. All my life, people had been taking me at face value, supposing that such a big, bluff, daredevilish-looking fellow must be heroic. But here was a new and wondrous misconception. Just because I tickled his funny bone years ago by my offhand impudence to Hardinge, and been hail fellow Flash Harry with the gift of popularity, as Thomas Hughes observed, I must therefore be good-hearted, and even humane and chivalrous. God help us, the kind of decent Christian whose conscience would be wrung to ribbons because he'd felt obliged to do away with an inconvenient nigger for the sake of the side. That was why Napier had been gassing away like a benign vicar, judging me by himself. quite unaware that I've never had the least qualm about kicking the bucket of evil bastards like Theodore, but only when it suited me. You may note, by the way, that for once my eyewitness report conforms exactly with accepted historic fact. All the world, Napier and Speedy accepted, believes that King Theodore took his own life, and all the world is right. I messed in Napier's tent that night with Speedy and Merriweather and a couple of staff wallopers, and Henty and Austin of the Times, the only correspondents. Henty was eager to know what I'd been up to, but Napier proved to have a nice easy gift of diplomatic deflection, and a frosty look or two from Austin showed Henty what the Thunderer thought of vulgar curiosity. "We must beware of the others, though," says Speedy later, when he and I were alone with Napier. "Stanley's a damn ferret, and his editor hates us like poison. The less they know of Sir Harry's activities, the better." I didn't see that it mattered, but Napier agreed with him.
"You should not become an object of their attention. Indeed, I think it best that your part in the whole campaign should remain secret. If it were known that you had been our emissary to Queen Mastiette's court, it would be sure to excite the correspondent's interest. And if they were to discover that you were alone with Theodore when he died, it might lead to unwelcome speculation."
Speedy was nodding like a mechanical duck.
"Fortunately, when Prideaux brought the news that you were in Theodore's hands, I was able to send another agent to Queen Mastiette to carry on the work you had so expertly begun. You will not mind," says he, giving me the bug hunter smile, "if I mention him in my dispatches rather than yourself? For security, you understand. Have no fear, your credit will be whispered in the right ears. And what's a single leaf more or less in a chaplet like yours?"
There was nothing to say to this, and I didn't much care anyway, so I allowed myself to succumb to the Napier charm.
"It means you'll be spared the labour of a written report," cries he genially. "You can do it verbatim, here and now. Give him a B&S, Speedy, and one of your cheroots. Now then, Harry, fire away."
So, I told him the story pretty much as I've told it to you, omitting only those tender passages with Ulubba and Mastiette, and that bint at Ulubba's amber, whose name escapes me. No, Mali, that was it, and the attempt on my virtue by Theodore's queen concubine. Nor did I tell them of my plunge down the silver smoke. Why? Because they wouldn't have believed it. But the horrors of Yando's aerial cage and the atrocities of Gondar and my ordeal at the hands of the kidnappers whom Ulubba had ordered to abduct me so that she could do me atrociously to death, and how I'd been rescued by Theodore's fighting women and Ulubba given her passage out, these I narrated in my best laconic, flashy style, and had Speedy's hair standing on end. An alarming sight.
"Impossible! I cannot credit it!"
He was horror-stricken.
"You say Ulubba tried to kill you?
Had Gala renegades carry you off so that she could
murder you? No, Sir Harry, that cannot be."
"I'm sorry, Speedy, but it's true." I was deliberately solemn now. "I would not believe it either had I not seen it. I know you had the highest regard for her, not least for her loyalty. So did I. But I know what she did, and—"
"But why?"
bawls he.
"Why should she wish you harm?"
He was in a great wax, glowering through his beard like an ape in a thicket, suspicion mingling with his shocked disbelief.
"It wasn't in her, I tell you. Oh, I know she was a vixen and cruel as the grave to her enemies, and would have seized her sister's throne, but that was honest ambition. She was true to her salt and to her friends."
"A moment, Speedy," Napier says.
"You may have touched it. Her designs on the Gala throne. Did she,"
turning to me,
"try to enlist your help in her coup? Because if she did, and was refused, might she not, in resentment—"
He was interrupted by Speedy's furious gobble of protest. Plainly, Ulubba had kindled more than mere professional admiration in his gargantuan bosom, and he simply could not bring himself to believe her capable of murderous betrayal. And yet here was the redoubtable Flashman swearing to it, so it must be true. But why? Fortunately, she was no longer alive to tell how I'd tried to kick her into a watery grave. Not that anyone would have believed her. After all, Mastiat hadn't. Still, it would be best if some perfectly splendid explanation of her sudden hatred for me could be found. An explanation that would convince Speedy beyond all doubt. Napier's wouldn't wash with him, but I had one that would lay him out cold. So I waited until his indignant wattling had subsided, and weighed briskly in. "Afraid that won't answer, Sir Robert. Oh, she'd have welcomed our help in usurping her sister's crown, but she never asked me point blank. Dare say she might have done, but as I told you, Theodore's riders pursued us. We were separated, and when I reached Mastiat's court, Ulliba had made her bid and failed and been arrested."
"With respect, Sir Harry," roars Speedy, showing no respect whatever. "We know that, but it don't answer the question why she should want you dead. Ah, oh, it's madness. I will not believe it."
And then he gave me the cue I'd been waiting for.
"What offence could you possibly have given her to provoke such malice?"
I sat frowning, tight-lipped for a long artistic moment, took a sip at my glass, sighed, and said, "The greatest offence in the world." Napier's brows rose by the merest trifle, but Speedy goggled, bewildered.
"What the... whatever do you mean, Sir Harry?"
I hesitated, drew a deep, reluctant breath, and spoke quiet and weary, looking anywhere but at him. "If you must have it, Speedy. Yes, your protégé, Ulliba Walk, was a first-class jangada, a brave and resolute comrade, as fine a scout and guide as I ever struck, and a vain, proud, passionate, unbridled, promiscuous young savage." What I could see of his face through the furs was showing utter consternation. He was mouthing, "Promiscuous?" dumbly, so I made an impatient noise and spoke quickly.
"Oh, what the devil! She made advances, I rejected 'em, and I dare say you've heard of the fury of a woman scorned?
Aye, think of Ulliba, a barbarian, a cruel vixen, as you've said yourself, scorned!" Now I looked him in the eye. "Does that answer you?" Between ourselves, I ain't sure it would have answered me, but I'm a cynical rotter. To decent folk, the sight of bluff, straight, manly old flashy, good-hearted, remember, badgered into saying things that shouldn't be said, damn it, traducing a woman's good name, and a dead woman at that, well, it's a discomforting sight. The man's so moved and reluctant, you're bound to respect his emotions. You wouldn't dream of doubting him. Speedy was making strange noises, and Napier answered for him.
"Yeah, I'm sure it does. My dear Sir Harry," Speedy sounded as though he'd been kicked in the essentials. I'm at a loss. I know not what to say."
He didn't either, muttering confused.
"Ulliba, so trusted, so wild to be sure, but depraved, a traitress, and to attempt your life, wounded vanity."
He made vague gestures.
I can only beg your pardon. I did not doubt your report for the moment, I assure you."
"Bloody liar.
But it seemed so impossible. I could not take it in."
Here he ran out of words and drew himself up, beard at the high port, shaking his great head while he clasped my hand. And I meditated on the astonishing ease with which strong men of Victorian vintage could be buffaloed into incoherent embarrassment by the mere mention of feminine frailty. Something to do with public school training, I fancy. "My dear chap," I clapped his arm in comradely style. It was like patting an elephant's leg. "I'm sorry, believe me. Truly sorry." Sigh. "I can guess what you feel. Disappointment, mostly, when someone lets you down. Well, best just to have a drink and forget it. What?" The Board of Inquiry sat next day and decided that Theodore had shot himself. A reasonable conclusion, given that Blanc testified that there were powder burns in the oral cavity and the back of his head was missing. But since the report didn't mention these details, and the verdict was what Napier and Speedy wanted, I dare say that they continued to believe that mine was the hand that fired the fatal shot. They buried Theodore next day in the ramshackle thatched amber church, at the request of his sad, pretty little queen, Tourou Walk. I loafed along out of interest, not respect. There were only a few on hand, the Queen, the boy, Alameo, a guard of the Duke's Irish, but no saluting volley, and fat little Damash, nursing a wound and terrified he'd be hanged for resisting our attack. I reassured him, and he gave a great sniff.
"And now you leave us without a king? We were born in bondage and must die as slaves. Why do you not stay to govern?"
I told him we didn't want to, and it was up to him and his like to govern themselves.
"You mean we must cut each other's throats," grumbles he. "This is Africa."
I told him to mind his manners and not interrupt the ancient dodder of a priest who was gabbling the service. The corpse had been nicely wrapped by Samuel, I believe. They shoveled it into the shallow grave, and that was the end of the heir to Solomon and Sheba and Prester John. They like to say he was mad, as though that paid for all, but I saw him sane as well as mad, and a vile, cruel bastard he was, as foul as Caligula or Attila, and got only a tiny part of what he deserved. I remember Gondar and the slaughter of Islamgi, and if anyone ever deserved a hell, he did. Meanwhile, the campaign was done, the captives free, Magdala in immense confusion, with thousands of Ab fugitives to be looked after, herded down into the plain and protected from the surrounding Galas, who, not unreasonably, were athirst for a share of the loot of the amber. They were disappointed, for the Mix and Sappers and little homes of the British Museum got in first, and the Galas were dispersed by rifle fire, which I thought a mite hard, since their blockade had been so vital to our success. As to the loot, I heard there was a fair amount of precious stuff picked up, but most of it was bought up by the prize master and sent down to Aragi on the elephants. For once, and for the only time in my experience of 60 years soldiering in heaven knows how many campaigns, there was no butcher's bill. We hadn't lost a man in storming Magdala, just 17 wounded, and with only 2 dead at Aragi and 1 careless chap who shot himself accidentally on the march up, I doubt if we had more than 6 fatalities in the whole campaign, mortally sick included. If there was nothing else to testify to Napier's genius, that casualty return alone would do, for I never heard of its like in war. I spent only 1 night on the Magdala Amber, for the place was as foul as a midden, and became a positive bedlam when the looters discovered a great cachet of Tej in the royal cellar. Private Shaughnessy and his chums came calling, eager to pay their respects and inquire after my health. "Sir Harry, man dear." It's hell to be popular with the riff-raff. So, after seeing Theodore planted, I took a mule down to Napier's headquarters at Aragi, and found myself a billet with Charlie Fraser, who commanded the staff and was colonel in my old regiment, the 11th Cherry Pickers. Not that it was much quieter there, for there were upwards of 30,000 Abs about the place, warriors as well as civilians who'd fled from Magdala. Among them were the 2 queens, Turuwalk and Tamagno, and their retinues, and nearly 300 of Theodore's political prisoners, princes and chiefs who'd been in the Amber's jails. Some of them had been in captivity for 15 or 20 years, and one for more than 30. I'd been lucky. The great tyrant had held me for less than a week, and now it was all over. The captains and the queens would shortly be departing, and I could rest content at last, with only a mild ache in my calf, and take my ease after dangers and hardships nobly borne, resigned to endure the discomfort of a ride to the coast, followed by a tranquil voyage home at HMG's expense. "You've come through again, old lad," thinks I. No public credit, perhaps, but Napier's right. You ain't short in that line. 500,000 in silver through your hands, and not a penny of it to bless yourself with, but what of that? Elspeth and I had enough between us. And the mere thought of her name brought the glorious realization that in a few short weeks I'd be reunited with all that glorious milk-white goodness that had been lying fallow. I hoped, but with her you could never tell, while I'd been wasting myself on Mexican trollops and suety fraulines and black barbarians. I could close my eyes and see her, taste her red lips, inhale the perfume of her blonde curls. Oh, the blazes with gallivanting about the world. I was for home for good this time, and the sooner Napier broke camp and marched north, the better. At that, he stayed not upon the order of his going. With Theodore dead, Abyssinia was without a ruler, and while Napier was adamant that the succession was no business of ours, he felt bound to settle the possession of Magdala itself, and ensure the safety of its inhabitants. That, he insisted, was a matter of national honour. But Magdala was the first horn of his dilemma. It lay in Gala territory, but Theodore had captured and held it for 10 years as a bulwark against Muslim encroachment on Christian Abyssinia, and Napier didn't want to change that. So it was decided to offer the amber to Gubaizi of Leicester, the closest available Christian monarch. From all I'd heard, he was a sorry muffin, but it was no concern of mine, although I'd have given the place to Mastiat for old Gallop's sake. She had the same notion, as did Warkaiti, her elder sister and rival for the supreme monarchy of all the Gala tribes. With Ulaba now singing in the choir invisible, they were the only claimants to the throne. And, sure enough, within 2 days of the fall of Magdala, up they rolled to Aragi to state their cases. Warkaiti was first to arrive, a plain, querulous creature, but not quite the witch-like crone I'd been led to expect. Her handicap was that while Mastiat had a son who'd make a king some day, Warkaiti's boy had been murdered by Theodore, and though she had a grandson, he was reputed illegitimate. She'd been consorting with Menelek, king of Shoah, the despised fat boy who had once laid siege to Magdala, but lost his nerve and turned tail when it was at his mercy. Now she made a poor impression on Napier, lamenting her misfortunes, railing against Mastiat, and looking less regal by the minute. Napier asked Speedy and me aside what we thought. I said that if it came to a war, Mastiat would eat her alive, having the men, the brains, and the will. Speedy agreed, adding that Mastiat had turned up trumps against Theodore and should be recognized Queen of Gala, whoever had Magdala. So that was Warkaiti for the workhouse. When Napier asked if she couldn't be reconciled with her sister, she let out a great screeching laugh and cried that if they made peace today, Mastiat would betray her tomorrow. Word came just then that Mastiat was expected hourly, and Warkaiti was off like a rising grouse, never to be seen again. I confess, I was looking forward to my Lion Queen's arrival, and she came in style, with an entourage of warriors and servants sashaying along under a great brolly borne by minions, her imposing bulk magnificent in silks of every colour, festooned with jewellery, a turban with an aigret swathing her braids, and bearing a silver-mounted sceptre. The whole staff were on hand to gape at her, and she acknowledged them with a beaming smile and queenly inclinations, head high and hand extended in regal fashion as Napier came to greet her. She was overwhelming, and for a moment I thought he'd kiss her hand, but he checked in time and gave her a stiff bow, hat in hand. He was about to present his staff when she gave a great whoop of Bashafalaka at the sight of Speedy, while I was favoured with a sleepy smile, but no sign at all of recognition. Since the last time we'd met had been at the Gallop on the floor of her dining room, I thought her demeanour was in quite the best taste, friendly but entirely decorous. To the others she was all dignified affability, being still sober. Napier clearly was impressed, and, as Speedy remarked to me, "There's our queen of all Gala, what?" They gave her dinner, and she entranced and appalled the company by laying into the goods like a starving python. As Stanley reported, she ate like a gourmand, disposing of what came before her without regard to the horrified looks. Pudding before beef, blancmange with potatoes, emitting labial smacks like pistol cracks. She also drank like a fish, shouting with laughter, more boisterous and vulgar with every draught, and no one, even Napier, seemed to mind a bit. It may have been her exotic novelty, or her undoubted sexual attraction, or simply the good nature that shone out of her, but I think there was also a recognition that despite her gross manners, she was altogether too formidable to be overlooked. Speedy and I were the only ones present who could talk to her directly without an interpreter, and when she'd spoken with him a few minutes alone over the coffee, she beckoned me to take his place beside her. Watching her across the table during the meal, I'd been bound to wonder what she knew of the fate of Ulaba Walk, if anything, and if she might refer to it. Now she did, but in a most roundabout way, and to this day I can only guess how she came to learn what befell on that ghastly night. Perhaps some galler escaped the massacre. I can only repeat what she said after I had filled her cup with Tej, and she had gulped it down, wiped her lips with the tail of her turban, and smiled her fat-cheeked saucy smile. "The Basha Falaka says I am to have $50,000. Your Deja's Napier, what a fine and courtly man he is, has pledged his word, but..." She pouted and took another swig. "He does not say whether I am to have Magdala." She looked a question. "If my word goes for anything, you will. But you know, it's been offered to Gobezi." She giggled maliciously.
"Gobezi will shudder away like a frightened bride. What, accept an amber surrounded by my warriors? He'd sweat his fat carcass to a shadow at the mere thought. No, he will refuse beyond doubt."
"Then Magdala's yours, Lion Lady. There is no one else." She nodded, sipped and wiped again, and sat for a moment. Then she spoke quietly.
"Uleba Wok is at peace now. My little Uleba who loved and hated me. Perhaps she loved and hated you also. I do not know, and I do not ask."
She took another sip and set down her cup.
"You were there when she died. No, do not tell me of it. Some things are better not known. Enough that she is at peace."
That was all she said to me, and I saw her only once more, on the following day outside her splendid silk pavilion, when Gobezi sent word that he was honored by the offer of Magdala, but on the whole, he'd rather not. So, the amber was hers, says Napier, but she must understand that he was bound to destroy its defences and burn all its buildings to mark the disapproval, that was the word he used, so help me, of its late ruler's conduct in daring to imprison and maltreat British citizens. She assured him that fire could only purify the place, and departed with her retinue, borne in a palki and smiling graciously on the troops who cheered her away. That same afternoon Magdala was set on fire. The king's own had it cleared of its last inhabitants by 4 o'clock. The sappers and miners had laid their charges, and presently, in a series of thunderous explosions, the gates and defences were blown up, the last of the cannon destroyed, and the whole ramshackle town, with its thatched palaces and prisons and houses, put to the torch. It went up in a series of fiery jets, which the wind levelled in a great rushing of flame, which, as Stanley says, turned the whole top of the amber with its 3,000 buildings into a huge lake of fire. The whole army watched, and I heard a fellow say that hell must look like that. But he was wrong. The summer palace burning, that was hell. Wonderful beauty smashed and consumed in a mighty holocaust. Magdala was a vermin-ridden place. The summer palace burning, that was hell. Wonderful beauty smashed and consumed in a mighty holocaust. Magdala was a vermin-ridden pest hole which its dwellers had been only too glad to leave. Indeed, they couldn't get far enough away from it, and it was a swarming multitude, tens of thousands strong, men, women, chicos, beasts, and all their paraphernalia, that set off from Arugi that same day, down the defile to the Bekello. That was Napier's other great concern, to see them safe beyond the reach of the Gala marauders, who'd been denied the plunder of Magdala, and were itching to make up for it at the expense of the fugitives. Our troops rode herd on them the whole way, but Napier would run no risks and had cavalry patrols escort them for another 20 miles beyond the river. The next day, the 18th, the army set off north, with the Sherwood foresters leading the way, their band thumping out "When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again" and "Brighton Camp," and behind them the native infantry sepoys, swinging along, followed by the jingling troopers, the Sindhis and lancers and dragoon guards, and behind them the guns and the matlows of the naval brigade. And last of all, the 33rd, the Irish hooligans of the Duke of Wellington's, the long khaki column winding down the defile, dirty, bedraggled, tired and happy, catching the drift of the music on the air and joining in. "I seek no more the fine and gay. They serve but to remind me how swift the hours did pass away with the girl I left behind me." Napier sat his horse by the track, with Speedy and Charlie Fraser and Merriweather and myself watching them go by. and how they roared and cheered and waved their helmets at the sight of him, the old bug hunter who'd taken them there against all the odds and now was taking them back again. He smiled and nodded and raised his hat to them, looking ever so old and weary, but content, turning in his saddle to gaze back at those three massive peaks where he'd wrought his military miracle, Salesi and Fala, gilded in the morning sun, and beyond them, Magdala, like a huge smouldering volcano, the plume of black smoke towering up into the cloudless sky.
"Going home now, gentlemen," says he.
And Meriwether said something about a great feat of arms and how the country would acclaim the army and its leader. Napier said he guessed the Queen and the people would be pleased, and HMG also, no doubt,
but you may be sure it will not be all unalloyed satisfaction. It never is.
Speedy wasn't having that.
"Why, Sir Robert, who can complain except a few miserable croakers? No doubt the same Jeremiahs who swore the campaign was doomed in the first place, and now they'll carp about the cost, as though such a thing was to be fought on the cheap with a scratch army and fleet. They've had it at bargain rates."
"I doubt the Treasury will agree with you," laughs Napier in high spirits.
"No, I was thinking rather of those wiseacres in the clubs and newspapers, who will find fault with us for doing no more than we were sent to do, rescue our countrymen. I dare say there will be voices raised in the House, demanding to know why we have left a savage country in confusion and civil war."
"Which is how it was for centuries before we came," cries Charlie.
"And the Ethiopian can't change his skin, can he? He'll go murdering whether we're here or not."
"The chief's right, though," says Meriwether. "There's bound to be an outcry, because we're not leaving a garrison to pacify the tribes and police the country.
Oh, and distribute tracts to folk who were Christian before we were, as though Abyssinia were a country to be pacified and ruled with fewer than 10 divisions and a great civil power, which would call for an expenditure of many millions, far more than we have spent, and with no hope of return."
Napier was smiling as he said it, but I wondered if some hint of censure had already reached him from home. They'd given him a free hand, and he hadn't stinted.
"And if we were to occupy the confounded place, Mr. Gladstone would never forgive us," says Meriwether. "What, enlarge the empire? Bring indigenous peoples to subjection and exploit them for our profit? Rather not."
There was general laughter at this, and Napier said with his quiet smile that we must resign ourselves to being regarded as callously irresponsible or rapaciously greedy.
"Brutal indifference or selfish imperialism, those are the choices. As an old Scotch maidservant of my acquaintance used to say, ye canna de right for deen wrang."
More laughter. And Charlie said, well, thank goodness at least no one could complain that there had been dreadful slaughter of helpless aborigines by the weapons of civilization.
"It wasn't our fault jolly old Theodore kicked the bucket," he added.
Meriwether said thank goodness for that, and I could feel the uneasy silence of Napier and Speedy. No doubt it was out of consideration for me that Napier checked his mount until I was alongside, and then says cheerily,
"You're very silent, Harry. Have you no philosophic reflections on the campaign? No views on what should or should not be done now that it's over?"
I glanced back at the smoke rising from Magdala like some huge genie escaping from his bottle, and then at the long, dusty column of horse, foot and guns swinging down the defile, and I thought of that hellish, beautiful land and its hellish, beautiful people, of Yando's cage and the horrors of Gondar, of bandit treasure aswarm with scorpions, of the terrifying thunder of descent into a watery maelstrom, of a raving lunatic slaughtering helpless captives, of fighting women drunk on massacre, of a graceful she-devil aglow with love and ice-cold in hate. I was finally aware of the gently smiling old soldier waiting for an answer as we rode in sunlight down from Aragee. "My views, sir? Can't think I have many. Oh, I don't know, though. Wouldn't mind suggesting to Her Majesty's ministers that next time they get a letter from a touchy barbarian despot, it might save them a deal of trouble and expense if they sent him a civil reply by return of post." On which, characteristically caustic note, the 12th packet of the Flashman papers comes to an end. That is the end of Flashman on the March. It was written by George MacDonald Fraser and read by Jonathan Keeble. This has been an ISIS audiobooks presentation. A previous title by this author, Black Ajax, is also available from ISIS. For further details of our extensive catalogue of audiobooks on cassette and CD, please call our free phone number 0800 731 5637.